This was the one we needed the hockey stick for. So I'll start by summarizing what I said yesterday, and maybe you thought of some questions about that, so we can stop and talk about that if so. Jumping to the differential forms formulation, electromagnetism is really about, and we know this especially from quantum theory, about a four-vector potential A that's a one form. And the field strength is the exterior derivative of it. And so because D of D is zero, this by definition actually satisfies Faraday's law. I guess Faraday wouldn't be so happy that his law is true by definition, but it is quite amazing how deep it is, I think, that it really is telling us the nature of electromagnetic fields. Okay, so that, I call that the covariant Faraday law. And then we have the other equations that relate the field to the source, to the current, and that's that the exterior derivative of the dual of this two form, I'll talk some more about duals today, actually, and even how to compute them in some situations. But for now, let's just say the dual, which I wrote down yesterday. The dual of a two form in four dimensions is another two form, so this gives us a three form. That is the current three form, which you write capital J. So these are Maxwell's equations written in terms of differential forms using Heaviside Lorentz units. Okay. Then I guess key things we want to remember are that I think I'll write it in tensor language first. FAB, that scalar, Lorentz scalar, is B squared minus E squared times a number which I already forgot, 2. So in any observer's frame, B and E will be different generally, but this combination is the same. And FAB contracted with its dual is, where did I write that? I think the coefficient is 4 or something. Does it matter? Whoops. 4. From the definition of the dual, this is really equivalent information to F. Well, let's write it out that way. So this is 1/2 epsilon ABCD, FAB, FCD. And because epsilon is totally anti-symmetric, we can totally anti-symmetrize on these guys if we want to. And this four form is proportional to F wedge F. The coefficient may be different. I'm not checking. But all I really want to point out is that if E dot B is zero, so that this invariant is zero, that's the same as saying that F wedge F is zero. And we call that the condition for a degenerate field. So F wedge F, let's put that. F wedge F equals 0 corresponds to E dot B equals 0, and it's called a degenerate field. And algebraically, it in four dimensions, if you have a two form that satisfies that, it actually means that it splits. It can be written as the wedge of two one forms. So a degenerate field can be written as alpha wedge beta. And this is called a simple two-form, which I'll sometimes say maybe, but not very often. That's a math term. And I guess we want to connect the properties of alpha and beta to the sign of this invariant. When b squared is greater than e squared, we say it's magnetic or magnetically dominated. And when b squared is less than e squared, it's electrically dominated. That would be negative. And when they're equal, and also this is zero, it's null. And so that translates into alpha and beta as saying, actually, might as well just think of an example to remember it. A simple example of a magnetic field, let's say in the z direction, with a constant magnitude, would be that in vector form. So how would we write that field as a two-form? We would say F is B naught dx wedge dy. I'm just using Cartesian coordinates in Minkowski space right now. So that has the form of this alpha wedge beta. In this case, alpha could be B naught dx and beta could be dy. Both dx and dy are space-like. So the magnetic case corresponds to the case where both of these guys are space-like. And we talked about the kernel of F, that is all the vectors that annihilate F when you contract with them. And in this case, those would be the vector in the t direction and the vector in the z direction. So let's say just to make this really concrete, the kernel of this F is the span of the two vectors d by dt and d by dz. So it's in particular, it's a time-like subspace. And I'll come back to that once I finish the review. Let's see. Right, and in the electric case, one of these will be time-like. So we'll have a time-like and a space-like. And the kernel will be space-like. And in the null case, one will be null and the other will be space-like, orthogonal to it. Okay, let's see. So then I guess the other basic thing was the condition for a perfect conductor. So if U is the four velocity of an observer, let's say, the electric field in the frame of U, in the U frame, let's say, is just U dotted into F, where I'm using the notation that I mentioned before that a dot, if you have a vector dot a form, that means that you contract the vector index with the first index on the form. So given that, if you have a perfect conductor and U is the rest frame of the conductor, and since the electric field vanishes in the rest frame of a perfect conductor, U dot F would be zero. So, and we could actually ask in this particular example, what are the frames in which the electric field vanishes for this particular electromagnetic field? And clearly, the frame at rest with respect to x, y, and z coordinates, when you would be just have a four velocity d by dt, and clearly when you contract that with this two form, you get zero, because you need a d by dx or a d by dy not to get zero. But you could also boost that any amount in the z direction, since d by dz is also going to give zero contraction with dx and dy. So there's a one parameter family of frames in which the electric field vanishes for this particular degenerate electromagnetic field. Okay. I think the next thing we went on to was magnetic helicity, and I wanted to just finish what I was doing right at the end there with that, and then we'll move on. So the helicity, or magnetic usually it's called H. I think it might be, people use lowercase h, but I don't remember for sure. You integrate over a three surface, the Chern-Simons three form, believe it or not, A wedge F. And as I mentioned, it's not gauge invariant, it's not a gauge invariant three form, but as long as you have appropriate boundary conditions, this integral is gauge invariant. And so, at least under some circumstances, the helicity is well-defined and gauge invariant. I should say that it's of interest to consider cases where you don't have those boundary conditions. And an example would be, I think I mentioned this earlier, the surface of the sun. You're considering helicity outside the sun. The surface of the sun is a boundary of your region in which you're calculating or defining the helicity. And it doesn't satisfy the required conditions. So people came up with an alternate definition of helicity, something like a relative helicity. And it's interesting, and I'm actually working on trying to improve on that definition, which means, I guess, make it more natural and generalize it. But I can't get into it right now, but if you're curious about it, I'd be real happy to talk about it.
So is it caught up with the surface of the sun because they don't want to know what's inside? I mean,
they don't know. They can't observe what's inside. And helicity is, yeah, I guess. And I think it's also because just by virtue of the dynamics, the helicity that's once it's outside doesn't feed back inside. So it's like a one-way source of helicity. By the way, it's also it sources it in opposite senses in the northern and southern hemispheres of the sun. So the net helicity injected is zero, but in one hemisphere, it's got a sign. Plasma physicists came up with this generalized definition because for them too, actually, they were interested in situations where the boundary did not satisfy the required conditions. So this had to be modified. And the way they set it up was to sort of compare the helicity defined this way to the helicity of a reference field determined by the boundary conditions. But there was some arbitrariness in the reference field, and I wanted a better definition. So that's what I'm working on.
Sounds like the boundary terms in the Gilbert-Einstein. So here you have a background. You know, if you do asymptotically flatness, you can define the action only relative to the asymptotic structure.
Oh, yeah. We should talk about this. Right, and this is conserved, so suppose it's in a situation where it's well-defined, it's conserved because this, you could call this the helicity current. Its exterior derivative is zero, so if we call this the helicity current, d of it, using the product rule for the exterior derivative, is just F wedge F. So for any degenerate field, that's zero. So whenever, if you have a conserved current, you get a conserved quantity, which is the integral of the current over a three surface. So the helicity is conserved. And it will be conserved approximately, even if F wedge F fails locally for short time and space regions. And so it plays a role in understanding how plasmas relax because they can dissipate energy, but not helicity to some extent. So minimizing energy at fixed helicity is an interesting thing to do. And we did that for a strictly magnetic, static magnetic field in Minkowski space. So for static B field in Minkowski space, minimizing the energy at fixed helicity implies helicity implied that the curl of B was proportional to B. In fact, it's equal to some constant times B. And since the curl of B is the current for a static field, this is equivalent to saying that the three current is a constant times B. This means that when we write down the Lorentz force, remember, we're talking about just a B field, so there's no electric term. That's just J cross B. But anytime J and B are parallel, that'll be zero. And in this case, they are parallel. Not only parallel, they're actually parallel with a constant coefficient. But so this is zero, so there's no force. And for that reason, this is termed force-free. And it's kind of intuitive that that would be the condition for minimizing the helicity, because because if the particles were being forced around the charges in this configuration, then it would seem like there's energy to lose. I'm not sure. But so we're minimizing the energy at fixed helicity, so it should be that they're just sort of gliding along without being forced anywhere. They can't radiate, et cetera. There's something confusing about this, though, that I want to mention. So this is called force-free. But there's a sense in which it's really not force-free. That's important, I think, conceptually. So an example of this might be one of these solar prominences that, you know, looks like a bundle of field lines like this. Here's the surface of the sun, temporarily just sitting there, some arc of plasma. It's changing, but slowly. On timescales in which it's not changing, it represents an approximately force-free configuration. On the other hand, particles, actual charges in it, are sort of moving along it like this, which is not a straight line, in case you didn't notice. So there must be a force on them. So how can we say it's force-free? Well, what we meant by force-free was that the macroscopic current is parallel to the magnetic field. So it's certainly conceivable that you have a flow of charges this way and that way, such that the current is always tangent to the magnetic field line. Nevertheless, individual charges in the current are clearly being accelerated. So, and in fact, the microscopic picture that's probably right here is that any given charge is executing cyclotron motion like this around magnetic field lines. So the charges are sort of stuck on the field lines to some degree. But we're not resolving this motion of individual charges, or even the equation of motion for the acceleration of an individual charge when we write this, when we treat the current as a continuous field. So I don't know. That's my understanding of what force-free means and doesn't mean. Luis, do you have any comment?
I have the same analogy. It'd be interesting to, I have never asked people like Spikowski that do particle in cell simulation. So what are the particles doing?
Mm-hmm. I wonder if they can resolve the cyclotron motion in the simulation. There's a term that describes this idea. I think it's called the guiding center approximation, that charges move as if they're stuck on field lines. By the way, I also would like to mention for completeness, it's not completely true. There's also something called drift, which is that they're not strictly stuck on the field lines. Depending on the gradient in the magnetic field, they actually can move to nearby field lines at some rate. And another effect that's not described here is they can radiate. There's something called curvature radiation. Well, of course, if they're undergoing cyclotron motion, they can radiate a kind of mini synchrotron radiation. But also, just from the curvature of the field line, they're going very fast on this curved trajectory. They can radiate from that acceleration. And that's called curvature radiation. So all those effects are not being included in what I said right there. Okay, so that's just background stuff to realize what's underlying the simple description. Okay. Another point I should make right away so this doesn't lead to confusion. Although this is force-free in the sense of a static field, it's not going to be force-free if it, let's say, it gets perturbed. In fact, just make a little bang on it and look at the wave modes in it or something. They are not, the inertia of the plasma in this situation is significant compared to the field energy. So this generic approximation that we're about to launch into, where we just completely neglect the force, any energy or momentum transfer to the particles, that won't be true in this situation. So it's not going to be force-free in the, let's say, dynamical sense. But for static fields, it's precisely force-free.
I'm trying to reconcile the what you just said. So I think I buy the, the differences that you get from the microscopic point of view where you see all those charges moving around,
mm-hmm.
and then the coarse grain view, which has none of this and looks as if you have a force-free configuration. But if it's true that the fine-grained motion creates radiation, I guess I would have liked to see that also from a coarse grain point of view.
Actually, I was going to ask you about that. So you could have possibility of dual gating, so it could be J dot E. It may not be zero. But I wonder if that's capturing implicitly the energy that is being lost.
In this case, there's no electric field. Yeah, if I'm just talking about a static magnetic field, I guess what I think is that this motion would also relax down the microscopic motion at some rate because of radiation.
Also, you're in the steady state situation where it's all been done.
Yeah, I guess.
Now you're going quantum on that.
If we quantize it, yeah. Don't forget, we got this by minimizing the field energy. We weren't worried about kinetic energy of particles. They weren't part of the description. Right.
Sorry,
yeah.
I had another
sure.
question about the variational principle.
Mm-hmm.
So you're doing variation on the potential.
Right.
I was wondering. So if you consider variations that are pure gauge, typically you get some interesting identities coming out of that. Do you know what comes out in this case?
Oh. No, I didn't think about that.
for homework.
Okay. Okay, so now I want to continue on towards the full dynamical force-free setting. And in preparation for that, I just want to complete the analysis or the description of generic degenerate fields first before we get to force-free. So we determined from an algebraic point of view, they are simple two forms, the wedge of 2-1 forms. And this was a nice example to keep in mind as a just of a uniform static magnetic field. And I wanted you to focus on the kernel of F. At each point, it's a two-dimensional space. And if it's a magnetically dominated field, it's a time-like space. And now, key thing, it's not any old F. We're talking about Fs that satisfy the covariant Faraday law. So it's a closed simple two-form. And that actually has a beautiful consequence. So if df is 0 and f is alpha wedge beta, we get this beautiful fact that the kernels of f are integrable. So they form two-dimensional surfaces in space-time. Another way to put that, or exactly related point, is that alpha and beta are exact one-forms. They're differentials of scalar functions. So let me explain that now, because that's a basic thing we need. So let's say, write it down, that df equals 0 and f equals alpha. Well, let's say f wedge f is 0. Implies that f is d of one scalar, I'll call phi 1, wedge d of another scalar, phi 2. These are called Euler potentials for this field. And this is really a beautiful and very useful fact. So remember, f really derives from a one form, A, that's got four independent numbers in it, not all of which are gauge invariant, but it has four numbers, and it's a one form. For degenerate fields, we need only two scalars. Scalars are simpler than one forms, and two is smaller than four. So it's a very nice simplification. And these are also, they're not gauge invariant, actually. You can make any nonlinear transformation of the pair phi 1 and phi 2 into another pair with unit Jacobian determinant, and that will preserve this two form. So there's a lot of ambiguity in how you choose the potentials, but you can always choose them. So let me explain why that's true. I think I'll just go ahead and prove it in a nice proof. Yeah, so let's do it this way. So if f wedge f is 0, so f is simple, we know the kernel of f at each point is two-dimensional. So let's pick some vector in that two-dimensional space, and let's do it everywhere in space-time. And then we get a vector field that annihilates F. So let U, I think I called it U, equals 0 everywhere. Okay, then we show that that implies that the Lie derivative of F with respect to U is 0. I'll just remind you why we use Cartan's magic formula, which says u dot df, this Lie derivative is u dot df plus d of u dot f. And df is 0 by Faraday's law, and this is 0 by assumption about u. So The lead derivative of f is 0. Now I want to find another vector such that the lead derivative that also annihilates f everywhere and which has 0 lead derivative with respect to u, and those two vectors will be surface forming. So let me pick a surface, a three-dimensional surface, that's transverse to the flow of u. This is u here. And on that surface, I can pick another vector field such that it annihilates f everywhere without any problem. So let's call that vector field B. So let B dot f equals 0 on sigma. Let's call the surface sigma. And now I want to extend B off of sigma by just the differential equation that sets its lead derivative 0 with respect to u. And so extend B off of sigma by lead derivative with respect to u of B is 0. So now we've got a vector field everywhere. We don't know yet that it annihilates f everywhere, but let's just check that. It does. So calculate the lead derivative with respect to u of b dot f. So the lead derivative satisfies a product rule. So we get the lead derivative of b dot f plus b dot the lead derivative of f with respect to u. By definition of how we extended b, this is 0. And by initial definition of u, this is 0. So this is 0. But this is a first order differential equation that this lead derivative is 0 for this one form. That one form is 0 everywhere on the initial surface. And this vanishing tells us that it's 0 everywhere. So this implies that b dot f equals 0 everywhere. So now I've got two vector fields, u and b. They both annihilate f everywhere. And Li u of b is 0. But that means that u and b commute as vector fields. So let me just write that. So Li u b equals 0. Just somehow the change of notation makes this more obvious. It's equivalent to writing it as the Li bracket of u and b is 0, which reminds us that if you have two vector fields whose Li bracket is 0, they're surface forming. They can actually, you can choose coordinates so that both of those vector fields are just coordinate vector fields. So this implies that u and b are surface forming. But that means that we've just found a distribution of, that means that the kernel of f everywhere is tangent to some two-dimensional surfaces. So this implies kernel of f is tangent, let's say, to the UB surfaces. And that almost finishes this. Remember I said I would show that also that F could be written as the differential of a pair of scalars. So how do I do that? Basically, we just choose coordinates adapted to these surfaces, and it pops out. Let me show that to you. So let's choose four coordinates for our space-time in two pairs. So let's adopt coordinates x a, where a runs from 1 to 2, and y I, I'll just use a different kind of letter to keep track of it, where a is over 1 and 2, and I is over 1 and 2. But I want to choose these coordinates so that on the surfaces, on the UB surfaces, I guess I want y1 and y2 to be constant. I think that's what I want. Yeah. Such that yi is constant on the UB surfaces. Then what does F look like? Remember the UB surfaces are the kernel. They're tangent. The kernel of F is tangent to them. So that means when I expand F in the differentials of these coordinates, since the y's are the ones that are constant on the UB surfaces, F must be expanded in dy1 wedge dy2 with some function here that a priori it could be a function of all the coordinates, but we'll see about that. Let's see, let me try to explain this better. Suppose F had a dx a in it, and x is not constant on the surfaces. But then if I contract with a vector tangent to the surface, I won't get 0. But by definition of these surfaces, I have to get 0. They are the kernel of F. So this F has to have this form. But F is also a closed two-form, so we should impose that. So df, we take the differential. We're going to take partial derivatives of f with respect to xa and with respect to y. The y's won't give anything because we already have all the dy's wedged there, so we'll get 0 if we wedge with another one. So this is just going to give us df dxa, dxa wedge dy1 wedge dy2. And this is supposed to be 0 by Faraday's law. And the only way it can be 0 is if this coefficient is 0. So F must actually not depend on XA. This equals 0 implies that F is actually just a function of the Y's. So now we've almost got our Euler potentials. We just have to redefine one of the coordinates to get this into the form of d of one function wedge d of another. So one way to do that would be to leave y2 alone, but trade y1 for another coordinate that's basically the integral of this. So we could say, let's define a new y1, y1 tilde, which will be a function of y1 and y2. Define it to be the integral from some 0 value up to y1 of f right? F of, now I need a dummy variable for y1, the y1 slot in f, so I'll call that s, comma y2. Integrate with respect to S. So that defines some function of y1 and y2. And if I take its differential, I have to take partials with respect to y1 and y2. The y1 differential will just give me dy1 times the integrand evaluated at S equals y1, the endpoint. this gives me f of y1, y2 times dy1. And then I have to also take a differential with respect to y2. So that gives me the another term. I'll just not even write it. It's the integral of the partial derivative with respect to y2 times dy2. I guess I'm changing upstairs and downstairs on my y's. Whoops, sorry about that. So that shows us that this combination, f dy1, is equal to dy tilde 1 minus this term. But this term is proportional to dy2, which has zero wedge product with dy2. So that means that, in fact, I've just shown that this combination is equal to dy1 tilde wedge dy2. So now we're done, because we can adopt y1 tilde as the first Euler potential and y2 as the second one. Let's call that phi1 and phi2. Okay. So let's now see what have we learned. We have a degenerate field. Faraday's law holds. That means it can be written this way in terms of two Euler potentials. The kernel is the vectors that annihilate f. Those are vectors that annihilate d phi 1 and annihilate d phi 2. Those are vectors tangent to a surface of constant phi 1 and constant phi 2. Now, constant phi 1 is a three-dimensional surface in four dimensions. Constant phi 2 is another three-dimensional surface. They intersect in a two-dimensional surface, and that two-dimensional surface is the integrated kernel of f. Okay. So let me pause for questions, if there are any, about the math, and then I'll say what it means in this example and more general ones.
I was wondering if there's not an alternative proof that would rely on the alpha wedge beta form for f. Because if you take this and you apply d to that, then you have d alpha wedge beta and then alpha wedge d beta. Maybe it's a little bit more direct to that alpha has to be a gradient.
Well, can you let me show you the steps you're saying, and you can tell me. I know how to do it if I'm allowed to invoke the Frobenius theorem in differential forms language. But so if we just say d of alpha wedge beta is 0, okay, that implies that d alpha wedge beta minus alpha wedge d beta is 0. Now we can wedge that with alpha, and we kill this term, and we learn that d alpha wedge beta is 0. And we can wedge it with beta to learn that the other term, d beta wedge beta is 0. And this is what I learned from the book by Choquet, Bruja, and DeWitt, Moret, is called a Pfaffian system of differential forms. And the system is integrable if the ideal generated by the forms is closed under exterior derivative, which this manifestly is when you look at it. So I have to invoke this fancy stuff, which is, I think, essentially, I think you can prove that fancy stuff by simply generalizing what I just did with the Lie derivative argument. But I don't know how otherwise to just look at this and say alpha and beta are, do you? Maybe you can.
No, I guess you'd want to conclude that the alpha by itself has to be 0 and the beta by itself has to be 0. But it's not clear that you're allowed to say that. But that's the outcome, right? Because the alpha is 0 means that alpha can be expressed as d phi 1.
Good point. Okay. Well, maybe it's only, it tells you d alpha is a linear combination of alpha and beta. And maybe that's enough to tell you, no, but it's not, that you can redefine it. But you haven't already concluded that the system is integrable, so I don't see how to use that. But there might be a way. Okay, so what is the significance of these surfaces? We called them, by the way, well, they were called by Carter flux surfaces, and Uchida also adopted that name. Let me write it down. So that tells us that the kernel of F are, they're called flux surfaces, according to Carter and Uchida. But if we think about what they really are, let's look at the example that I wrote down of the constant magnetic field and mention that again. So for this simple example, these flux surfaces are just the TZ planes. And Z is the direction of the magnetic field. So it's really like you take a magnetic field line and then extend it in space-time to a family of magnetic field lines that sweeps out a surface. But you have to do it in such a way that the extension is done along a congruence of observers for whom there is no electric field. So I can extend my initial field line. Here's a magnetic field in the z direction. I can just sweep it up like this if this is the t and this is z and x and y are perpendicular to the board. Just move it up like that. So the field, the flux surface is foliated by magnetic field lines as seen by an observer who sees no electric field. Or I could actually think about my observer boosted in the z direction, and I'll get the same surface, although I'll get, of course, different field lines because they'll be Lorentz boosted. So I'll get a sliced version of this for a Lorentz boosted observer. But I get the same flux surface. However, of course, if I take a different observer that's moving out of the board, they will see an electric field in addition to a magnetic field, and that's not, you know, allowed. That's not how I continue the magnetic field line. I mean, there's no meaning to following a magnetic field line generically in space-time. This is the moral. But if the field is degenerate, and if it's magnetically dominated, then you get this preferred notion of how to follow a particular magnetic field line from one time to the next. But really, you don't quite get that because depending on the observer, you would define the magnetic field line one way or the other. What you get in an invariant sense is this flux surface. So a degenerate field that's magnetically dominated foliates space-time by these flux surfaces. Sam and I called these, we didn't like this name so much because it wasn't very intuitive to us. It seemed really like, and in fact, Uchida said this in his article, what we're looking at here is the world sheet of a magnetic field line thought of as a kind of string. So why not call them the field sheets? Like world sheet, field line, field sheet. So that's what we call them. And we're used to it now, so you're going to have to put up with it. Okay, and again, let me just emphasize one more time. They're well-defined anytime you have a degenerate field that's magnetically dominated. Actually, they're also well-defined if it's electrically dominated, but then they won't be time-like field sheets. They'll be space-like field sheets. Okay. Let's see, where did I leave my paper? Wait a second. Please, as you know, all throughout this, anytime, ask questions and stop me.
Is there something interesting that happens if alpha is not like globally defined? If there's a discontinuity or beta, just those things, like in terms of the field sheets, do they look funny in that case? Or
I think they do, but I can't pull out of my hat an example. But I know of a paper where something is looked at that way. It has topological properties. Another issue actually is, even before you worry about that, what about these potentials not being globally defined? And an example that comes up very often is just in axisymmetry, one of the potentials may be the azimuthal angle. And that's actually, I'll show you when we get to the monopole. It's important that it has a jump, but it's not like a problem. But it's definitely a feature. Yeah, I guess it's a feature, not a bug. Okay, so now we're gonna, now what I'd like to do is motivate the full force free approximation by thinking about what's happening around a pulsar. And then we'll get on to full dynamical force free fields and the action principle for them and solutions that describe their kind of physics. I guess we don't need this anymore. So force-free electrodynamics and pulsars. So what we need to do is consider a magnetized spinning object. It's a, and it doesn't even have, even though a pulsar that's pulsing will have a magnetic axis that's not aligned with the spin axis. What I'm saying here can equally well apply if in the aligned case. So let's just consider that. So we have a magnetized spinning object. The geometry is a little bit complicated, so let's just simplify it by considering a spinning disk, a Faraday disk. And let's say it's just in a uniform magnetic field. Here's the axis of spin. Then this would be, say, a conducting metal disk. Charges carried along with the lattice of the metal are going to be going along circular paths. And their velocity is perpendicular to the magnetic field, so they feel Lorentz force, F equals Q V cross B. And V cross B will be radial on this disk, so there'll be a Lorentz force in the radial direction. So a potential difference will develop between the center and the edge of the disk. And that means that if we were to connect a wire to the edge of the disk, and let's say the axis is also a conductor, and put a resistor here, we could actually drive a current through the resistor just by virtue of the disk spinning in this magnetic field. And roughly speaking, that's what's happening with the pulsar, is it's like a generator. in the same sense. Of course, there's no wire, but what's the wire in the pulsar case? It has to be free charges that can move around and sort of form a closed circuit. So if you just have a spinning pulsar in vacuum, you don't have that. So of course, this won't happen. But it turns out that a pulsar sort of fills up its environment naturally with charge, with a plasma. And that's because of the large electric fields that develop. So here, remember, there's a potential difference here. It's going to scale with the velocity, which is proportional to the angular velocity of the disk. So the bigger this is, and the bigger the magnetic field is, the greater the potential difference is going to be, and the greater the electric field that develops is going to be. So if it's a big enough electric field, it will accelerate any stray charges that are around. It might even be big enough to rip charges out of the surface of the neutron star. In any case, it'll accelerate stray charges. They will, in this geometry, be moving along in these cyclotron spirals on magnetic field lines. And they'll be accelerated very rapidly. They'll be emitting radiation. That radiation can actually scatter off the strong magnetic field and create pairs. The pairs are accelerated. And so they create more radiation and more pairs, and there's a cascade, or at least there could be, quite plausibly, a cascade of pair creation that fills up the environment with a pair plasma, which then plays the role of these wires that connect this circuit. So something we want to check right away is how much energy is in the mass of the pair plasma compared to how much is in the field. And if it turns out that the field energy is much, much bigger than the mass energy of that plasma, then the force-free approximation could be a good description. So to check that, we need to know how much plasma will be created. And what happens is that, you know, if enough plasma is created, it can the charges will screen the electric field and basically short it out. Not short it out, but screen it. So there's a famous old analysis from 1969 by Goldreich and Julian. If assuming that you have this plasma that's co-rotating with the star, and they just calculate what should be the density of charge in order to completely screen the electric field. So the idea is that until it's completely screened, more charge will be generated, but eventually that will shut off the field will be screened, and that will shut off the pair creation process. So let's take that as our density of charge and then do this comparison. So it's called the Goldreich Julian, I'll put in parentheses, screening charge density. And it turns out it's just scales like the product of omega times b. So I think I won't stop to derive that. This is from 1969. Let's see, how can I want to keep that showing, so I'll switch to this board. Now, if we know the charge density, we also know the mass density if we know the charge to mass ratio. So we can assume the charges are electrons, and we can assume that there's only one sign of charge. The minimum the minimum number of particles we can screen with is to have all one sign. So let's assume they're all one sign, and we'll calculate the minimum. Then we'll get the magnetic just see which way I wanted to do the ratio. Yeah, the field energy density. Divided by the mass energy density of the particles. So the plasma mass energy density. So the field density goes like B squared. The mass density is the mass divided by the charge times the charge density. So this is, let's say, for electrons, mass over E, that being the electron mass. Times the Goldreich-Julian charge density, omega B. And this is the same as EB over M divided by omega. And this happens to be the cyclotron frequency for a charge moving in a magnetic field B with a mass M. That's the frequency of its circular orbits if it's non-relativistic. Actually, I think you have to put a gamma M for the relativistic case. So we'll write this as omega cyclotron divided by omega of the star. So now comes the question, how big is omega cyclotron? For a neutron star, this omega comes, I guess it's like for the Crab pulsar, a 60th of a second is the, so it's 60 hertz. Maybe it's between a millihertz and a hertz. I don't actually know much about the population of neutron stars, but or pulsar spin frequencies. But it's not going to matter. A factor of 10 to the 3 will be irrelevant in what I'm about to do. Because it turns out this is so huge compared to this, it just doesn't even matter. So how big is this? Well, the field, if you put in a field of one Tesla, just to compare, it's actually a field of about 10 to the 12 Gauss, or 10 to the 8 Tesla, I guess, in a typical pulsar. But let's just get it for one pulse Tesla and then multiply by the number. So EB over mass of the electron is equal to B divided by one Tesla times 10 to the 11 hertz. So already for a one Tesla field, this is going to be huge, many, many orders of magnitude bigger than this. And for a 10 to the 8 Tesla field, it's just ridiculously huge. So presuming that the amount of charge around is comparable to this Goldreich-Julian density, we have supremely good reason to think the force-free approximation should be good. In fact, it's a good thing that it's supreme because we'd like to also, well, not we'd like to, people did apply it to spinning black holes. It would be nice if it works because it's such a simple description of a plasma. If you can get somewhere with it, that would be good. A spinning black hole may be, you know, a supermassive black hole will have a much smaller spin frequency and probably a much smaller magnetic field. But we have a lot of room to play with here. Because in fact, once we multiply this by 10 to the 8, it's 19 orders of magnitude, or maybe 16 to 19 orders of magnitude, greater than the spin velocity. Velocity. Somebody, you're scrunching your forehead, Eric.
No, well, I'm just curious about the gold
yeah.
The Goldbrecht-Julian expression. So, and can you give us a bit of intuition behind this? I mean, I'm trying to think of the, you know, the Schwinger process for pair creation that depends.
You're thinking. That's much more dynamical than you need to think. You just think about a stationary situation of and how much charge would be required to screen the electric field in a stationary configuration. So you could solve this by actually writing down an assumed stationary configuration and solving for it. I did it a couple of days ago, just even more crudely. You can just instantly get it if you just think very crudely about a surface layer of charge. You can say, I want to cancel the electric field at the surface here, which I can just simply get from the induced electric field. The electric field vanishes in the co-moving frame of the conductor. So then in the stationary frame, I'll have an electric field that's V cross B. So I know what the electric field is. And then I could say, now I want to put a bunch of charge there. And now let me think of it as a kind of surface charge density. And I know that the field outside of a plane, a uniform infinite plane of charge density is just equal to the surface charge density. So I'll just set that surface charge density equal to my electric field that's induced. And then I'll put in a length scale to, what am I saying? So this is a volume charge density. So I have to convert that to a surface charge density. So I just use the one length scale in the problem, which is the radius of the thing, and this pops out.
Right.
So that's the simplest way I could see to come up with this, roughly.
Right, that's how you convert from linear velocity to angular velocity.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess anything more sophisticated than this would modify the
coefficients.
Coefficient by
exactly. Yeah, I mean, in this case, it's not essential because we just all we want is how the order or how it scales. Yeah, maybe I should have done that because actually I never saw that explanation anywhere. It's the quickest way to see it. Okay, so that's a great thing. And so now that gives us license to charge ahead, feeling like there's really a physical situation where this force-free approximation may be a good idea. Now, I wish Bianca were here because I decided I would start with the action principle in the way that she wanted to see it done. Might as well do it anyway. So now I'm going to discuss a couple of action principles for force-free, just to derive the equations. Because, so let's put it this way. Force-free corresponds, as we said earlier, to the field strength contracted with the forecurrent is zero. This means that the stress tensor for the field is conserved by itself, which means there should be a Lagrangian formulation of just the field dynamics, and you just forget everything else. And what is that? Well, the Lagrangian or the action for the electromagnetic field is the integral of FAB, FAB. If it were just a free electromagnetic field. But now we want to put in the fact that it's degenerate as a kinematic constraint at the level of the action. So we want to say it's not any old FAB. We're only talking about the dynamics of degenerate fields. The simplest way to do that is to just, instead of writing F equals dA like this, we could just write F equals d phi 1 wedge d phi 2. Just replace the Euler potential expression in the action. In fact, I think I'll just do it that way. I won't do it Bianca's way right now because she's not here. So we could write this thing in terms of differential forms this way. It's just 1 half f wedge the dual of f. And now I'm going to substitute the Euler potential. So let's do a degenerate at the kinematic level. Then I'll just say my action for force-free. Well, I shouldn't say force-free. I should say for degenerate fields is going to be integral of minus 1/2 d phi 1 wedge d phi 2 wedge the dual of d phi 1 wedge d phi 2. So Uchida did not use differential forms notation, but he did basically write this action. So he noted that you can basically think of degenerate electrodynamics as a field theory. It's a theory of two scalar fields. It's sort of strange because it has 1, 2, 3, 4 derivatives in the action. So immediately you'd worry that if you were just inventing field theories, you know, as a theoretical physicist for fun, this might be one you would invent pretty quickly. But you would say, oh, but that one's no good because it's got four derivatives. So it'll have higher derivatives. But it doesn't have higher time derivatives because of the wedge. So at most, one of these two could be a time derivative. And at most, one of these two, well, actually, you're dualizing. So for the dual to be a time derivative, at most one of the dual can be a time derivative. So actually, there are just two time derivatives here. On the other hand, you can't perturb around zero field because the coefficient of the two time derivative term in the action will involve space derivatives of the fields. So the dynamics will be well defined around a background that has non-zero field. For example, a non-zero constant magnetic field, but not around zero field. That's important because, you know, when we said force-free corresponds to, it's a good time to make this point. I said if F contracted with some vector is zero, then F is degenerate, for example, the current. But if that vector is zero, if it's the zero vector, then of course, you can't conclude anything about F. So it's important that the current is not zero, but the current is the divergence of F. So if F is zero, that's, okay. So you really need to be perturbing around non-zero current or non-zero field, at least, for it to make sense. So here's the action. We can find the equations of motion in the usual way by varying phi 1 and phi 2. And whatever we get, those will be true equations that are implied by Maxwell's equations, because all we've done is some restricted set of variations of the vector potential. But if we're looking for solutions in which F is degenerate everywhere, this is going to give us those enough equations to determine those solutions. So variation of S degenerate equals zero. We're just going to vary this phi 1 and this one. These two will just give us the same contribution because of the symmetry. Here we can switch the star to the other two form, and we'll just get a double the contribution we got from the first one. So all we have to do is vary this one phi. And we just get integral minus 1/2 d of the variation of phi 1 wedge d phi 2. Let's just call this f. Now we want to integrate by parts this total derivative, this derivative. So we write this as a total derivative plus the other term that we introduced. Let's see. I guess I can lower this to the bottom. So this is equal.
I may have just missed what you just said, but so you don't have a second term because it gives you.
I will. Let me write out what I exactly have. So, a second term, you mean, how did I get this line? I just get the same contribution, so I should multiply by 2. So this is minus the integral, and now I'll write this as a total derivative. When I expand this out, the first term I get is exactly this one. And then I get minus, because I have to commute the d past this one form, d of this thing. So I didn't start with that, so I have to add it back in. So it's this plus delta phi 1 wedge d of d phi 2 wedge star f. So if the fields vanish at infinity, this we can drop our boundary term. And the variation vanishing for all d phi 1 tells me that this must vanish. So that's my field equation. So if this is equal to 0 for all delta phi 1, that implies that and similarly, if I varied phi 2, I would get the same equation with phi 2 replaced by phi 1. So these are the field equations of force-free electrodynamics. It says that you've got two currents that are conserved. This we gave these guys the name of Euler currents just because they're formed from the Euler potentials. So the two Euler currents are conserved is the equations of motion. We could rewrite it if we want, and in fact we do want, because for practical purposes, we might as well use the product rule to act this d on here and get 0, and act it on here and get the current. So this is equivalent to saying that d phi 2 wedge, the current, is 0, and d phi 1 wedge, the current, is 0. I should enclose this. And this is going to turn out to be the really convenient form for these equations. Notice that the current is a 3-form. This is a 1-form. So this is a 4-form. So it's really like a scalar equation. I just have 2 scalar equations. Let's check if this is really, this should correspond to what we started with. Okay, this is a curiosity. All I assumed was degenerate when I did this. I didn't say anything about force-free, right? Look what happened, let me just remind you. I took the standard Maxwell action. I assumed at the kinematic level that the field was degenerate, and I got these equations. But in fact, these equations are exactly the same as the statement that F contracted with J is 0, as I'll show you right now. So then we have to understand, why is it that we're getting force-free automatically just by assuming degeneracy? And the reason is that we're asking for a field equation satisfied autonomously by these two fields, phi 1 and phi 2. That is, it's going to be automatic by the covariance of this action that the stress tensor of this field is conserved by itself. But this field is the electromagnetic field. So if the stress tensor is conserved, that's exactly the same as saying that F dot J is 0. So it actually is to be expected that if you start with an action principle like this, you will get the force-free equation. But let me explain how this and this are the same, because I don't think it's quite obvious. Well, it is once you get used to it, but it's not initially obvious.
I asked a quick question.
Yeah.
You brought up the Euler currents, which was that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is that just the same as phi times the current? Like, because seems like if you shuffle around the d's, you can just get phi wedge d star f.
Oh, yeah. Wait a minute. Right, but that'll be equivalent to this equation. So you're saying write this as d of the whole thing minus phi 2 times the current.
Yeah.
But since d of the whole thing times d is 0, I might as well say that phi 2 times the current is the Euler current. Yes, thank you. For some strange reason, I don't think, well, actually, my memory is really bad. I probably did think of that and then forgot. But thanks for reminding me or telling me. Yeah. Actually, of course, we could say it at this level also because dj is 0. So yeah, that's great.
Another question. So if instead of proceeding through the action principle, you wanted to derive this from just plugging what you have for f,
yeah,
knowing that it's degenerate into Maxwell's equation.
Right. Yeah, I'm about to do that right now. Mm-hmm. That's what I was saying isn't quite obvious, but let's see how that works.
I'm always worried about this thing that, you know, you can make a substitution inside the action and get something which is not equivalent to getting the field equations, making the substitution after.
That's right.
I'm always worried about these things.
You should worry. Well, don't forget, though, that what you should be worried about is not that you're getting some wrong information, but that you're getting incomplete information. That is, if you make a restricted set of variations of the action should still be stationary under those, so whatever you find out will be true, but you might be missing some information. But here, we have enough information to determine everything, so we're not missing anything. I mean, you don't know that until you start looking at it, but. Okay, so let's see. Let's try to just translate the force-free condition in a tensor form into this form we just wrote. It's very simple. So first step is to rewrite the current as a three form. So this is equivalent to saying that FAB times epsilon BCDE, the current three form CDE, is 0. And that's equivalent, because this is totally antisymmetric in BCDE, we can get rid of the epsilon and just write that as saying FA times the totally antisymmetric part of BCDE is 0. Now, we would be stuck at this point if F were a generic tensor. But now we put in the fact that F is simple. And then this is alpha A beta B contracted with J C D E minus beta A alpha B contracted with J C D E equals 0. And now we use the fact that, so this is just some, the fact that alpha and beta are linearly independent. If they weren't, F would be 0 to begin with. We're assuming F is not 0. That means that if this is 0, both of these terms must be 0. But that means that this must be 0 and so must this. So this is equivalent to saying that alpha wedge J is 0 because that's the totally antisymmetric product of those two tensors, and also beta wedge J is 0. But then remember, alpha and beta were, whoops, it's somewhere behind there, but anyway, alpha and beta are d phi 1 and d phi 2. So this is alpha wedge J and beta wedge J. So indeed, it's precisely the force-free condition. Okay, now probably this is a good time. Right. Okay, this is a perfect time to take a break. And what we'll do after the break, now that we know the equations of motion of the theory and what the fields are and why we should be interested, let's start looking at solutions of these equations and how do you solve them and what do they describe. We'll do that. Let's start in 15 minutes.